established for so long, and I'm not expecting at this point very much out of either one of them. They just seem to be so thoroughly entrenched and corrupted that they're incapable of self-correction at this point.
That's terrible. Even another thing that the Greens were for is to have instant runoff. In other words, if one of, say, three candidates or four or five doesn't win half or more than half, then they have to have another deal. They said put down first and second choice. And then, Gore would have gotten in if they allowed the Greens to do that, because most of the Greens would have put the Democrats, as much as they don't like them.
Right,
they think the Republicans are worse. So they would have just had Gore's second choice, and he would have been a shoo-in. But that's one of the things they should be doing now.
Yeah, that's a very good point. There's a lot of ways that elections could be reformed. I think instead of having it just one day, it could be over 2 days. It would
sure.
be, say, 1 week day. It could be a Friday, Saturday, or a Sunday, Monday. So
sure.
something like that would give people a lot more opportunity to vote. I really am against these voting machines that they're coming up with. The electronic ones.
Oh, yeah.
The computerized ones. I mean, I have an article here by a fellow who does security up in Reno on all the casinos and so forth, and operates the computer security up there, and he says, if there's a computer, it can be hacked. If you have someone with a will and a motivation, and actually some of these computer machines actually have a modem that can be accessed by a phone. In other words, it's like if we had a vote counting machine here in Santa Cruz County, mm-hmm. somebody in New York on a cell phone could dial into it and hit a few keys and change the outcome. So I'm really opposed to these computerized election voting.
Well, in Canada, they were doing them by hand, and they did it real fast. If they get organized, and they counted their stuff real fast, no problem. It was all hand counted.
It could
There's
really...
no reason why we can't do that here, instead of worrying about all the shenanigans that they were pulling,
That's absolutely true. Yeah, I think... So there's a lot of really good election ideas. I'd like to see, maybe the Greens and a few of the Libertarians and Peace and Freedom, whatever. I mean, even the Democrats and Republicans, if they on the local level, if they want to do participate, but actually get together and come up with some real honest to goodness election reforms and some of these ideas and implement them and create a drive for it. So. Good ideas there, and I'm really glad what the distinction you made. That was one of the thoughts that hit me as I read that, you definitely pointed that out very clearly.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, thank you.
All right. Good
Bye.
Night. Well, that was one person's impression of going up to the city up there and what he saw. He mentioned this last caller about what the protesters were protesting and so forth, and this war going on. And here's an article by Pete Stark, who's a Democratic representative from California. And I may not agree with everything he says here or what he is proposing, but I think it does bring out some realities about this war. And what do you say about this Iraqi war that's being proposed? He says, who will pay for the war? He says, school kids will pay. There will be no money to keep them from being left behind, way behind. Seniors will pay. They'll pay big time as the Republicans privatize Social Security and rob the trust fund to pay for the capricious war. Medicare will be curtailed and drugs and more be made more unaffordable. Now, seeing these points, I think personally, that what we really need to do is have an honest monetary system, honest tax system, and we wouldn't need to have these kinds of welfare. If we abolish corporate welfare, I don't think we'd need personal welfare. One of the greatest instances of corporate welfare is the Federal Reserve System as it exists. It's the number one cause of disparity between the super rich and the rest of us. And that's where I think it's one of the short sights, shortfalls of the Democratic Party and most so-called liberals, not understanding the monetary system. Of course, that works on both sides. I think there's a lot of Republicans and conservatives out there that are just totally clueless about how the Federal Reserve makes it absolutely impossible for a free market enterprise system to exist. It doesn't exist. We're not in a capitalistic system right now. So that's one of the shortcomings on that side. But he goes on and basically talks about how working folks will pay through the loss of job security and bargaining rights. Our grandchildren will pay through the degradation of our air and water quality, and the entire nation will pay as Bush continues to destroy civil rights, women's rights, and religious freedom in a rush of phony patriotism, according to the Pharisees of the religious right, he talks about. So there will indeed be a lot to pay if this war does happen. Well, this is Tom Clooney. It's been my privilege to be with you again from Monday 7 to 8. And I have about 3 hours of information here that I tried to get through in 1 hour and didn't quite make it. There's a whole stack here that I didn't even begin to get close to touching. And we'll try it again next time. Thank you very much for being with us. We need leaders who lead us, not stickers who bleed us, and take all our money and send it abroad. We must be Americans, we need prayer in the schools, and more things made in USA.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station, not necessarily. They're my views, views of our guests, views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us tonight Dr. Joe Douglas, and Dr. Joseph Douglas lives back in Washington, D.C. He's written the books we've reviewed in the past, Red Cocaine, going into, of course, the communist influence in the smuggling of drugs into this country, and, of course, what a wonderful way to corrupt our nation. Of course, it never could have been accomplished without help from certain people within this country refusing to address the issue. And then, of course, his most recent book, Betrayed, The Story of the Men We Abandoned. And, of course, as we move into another war, I think it's important that we understand what happened in the past. We betrayed our fighting men during the First World War. We betrayed many of our fighting men, about 20,000 of them, during the Second World War, again in Korea, again in Vietnam. Even in the last war, Commander Spiker was a naval officer shot down over Iraq, and of course we could hardly wait to declare he was dead and write him off the books. Only recently have they reclassified him as missing in action, but had it been left completely to our military leaders, why, they would have simply written him off, as we've written off all the other men that have been abandoned. And of course, Dr. Douglas has done a wonderful job of cataloging and documenting the truth about what's happened. Now, the reason I say this is I love this country, but I also realize we have some very evil and wicked people in positions of power. And as President Reagan had said so well, that any nation that will betray its fighting men will eventually betray its own citizens. And I believe that. And I believe that if we do not bring out the fact of what's happened in the past, then why should we be surprised if these same wicked people who have betrayed our boys all during the 20th century should eventually end up betraying us? Because their goal is not the Constitution or individual freedom. They have a different goal. And I believe that is a new world order and a new world religion. But right now, let's get to Dr. Joe Douglas. Dr. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us again.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, let's get a little bit in the background of how you happened to write the book, the background of what happened, and then we'll just talk about the First World War, the Second World War, and then the wars of the Korea and Vietnam. But how did you happen to really get involved, and how did you happen to write a book like this? Because I know you put an awful lot of work into it.
Well, the key person, of course, is General Jan Sena, whom I met and began working with in the late 1970s. And he was a guy that had a prodigious memory and, of course, as you recall, operated right at the top of the Czech decision-making hierarchy. And we started talking about a number of problems. Of course, the narcotics trafficking was one. And then I started probing the chemical and biological warfare issue with him, found out that he was a gold mine of information there. And one of the very interesting things that came out was the fact that the Soviets were using U.S. prisoners of war to test new chemical and biological warfare agents. And that little piece of information then got me working on, well, what happened to these POWs? Where were they? How did the Soviets get into this? Of course, in the back of my mind is, why hadn't I ever heard anything like this?
All right, fine. Now, Major General Sena was a Czechoslovakian officer, very, very high in the communist organization in Czechoslovakia, who had defected to the United States. When did he actually come here?
He actually came here at the end of February in 1968.
And he was one of the highest-ranking officers ever to defect from the Soviet Union, wasn't he?
He was the highest, and to my knowledge, there's nobody that could even qualify for second place.
Well, now, why did he come to America? Why did he leave Czechoslovakia and come here?
He was running for his life. He had run into, he'd been under surveillance by top Soviet officials, in particular General Yepyshev, who headed the main political administration for watching over the Army and the Navy in the Soviet Union. And then in late February 1968, he learned about the Soviet plans for invading Czechoslovakia because of the liberalization that had been introduced by Dubček. And when he learned about that, he went to Dubček with the idea of trying to get him to change his course a little bit so as to foreclose the need for a Soviet invasion. And, of course, he forgot at the time that the Soviets probably had Dubček's office bugged, which they did, and the next day he learned that his immunity as a member of parliament was going to be lifted on Monday, and this was Friday, and so he knew what that meant. He had been found out and was going to be arrested, and that would be the last the world would ever hear of him, and so he knew that was the time he had to leave. He couldn't wait any longer.
All right, fine. Now, of course, he actually had a key position in the party, a key position in Parliament, as well as being the equivalent of about, what, a brigadier general?
Yes, that was the rank, but of course the rank is doesn't mean anything. It's the position that counts over there. And he was the first secretary of the party, a top party official at the Ministry of Defense, and also the chief of staff to the Minister of Defense. And not only that, but he also for a number of years ran the Secretariat of the Defense Council, and the Defense Council is higher than the Politburo when it comes to matters of intelligence, counterintelligence, defense, national security, and for all practical purposes, the foreign affairs and the economy. So he was really right up at the top and knew what was happening all around Czechoslovakia.
And, of course, he even had contacts in the Soviet Union, too, didn't he? So he
absolutely.
At least had some
in fact,
idea.
Khrushchev was his sort of mentor, you'd say, and he went to parties and cocktail parties and outings, if you will, with people like Brezhnev and Gretschko and Suslov and Ponomarev, the top people, not only the Soviet Union, but also East Germany and Bulgaria and Romania and North Korea and China and Vietnam and Cuba. He was very good friends with Raul Castro, for example, who came usually through Czechoslovakia three or four times a year as part of their getting instructions from the Soviets.
So, of course, he was in a key position within the communist hierarchy. Didn't he, of course, realize that, you know, it didn't matter how important you were, sooner or later, something would happen and they would come after you? I mean, this is the way that the communist system has worked. It seems always to eventually destroy its own. There are very, very few of the original members of the communist party that created the revolution. I think almost all of them were executed sooner or later.
That's true, and there's you can't offer a mild manner about any of the activities of the Communist Party if you expect to survive there. I mean, you have to promote the anti-U.S. feeling and, in a sense, you know, be one of the leaders of promoting hatred toward the United States. And you have to go totally along with the party positions and understand it and never forget it, which is where his good memory came in, but he also had a tremendous sense of the politics and understood what these concepts mean. And the problem, of course, is most of the people over there, or a large percentage of them, really don't understand, even these are the communists, they don't understand how cutthroat the system is and what is really meant by things like democratic centralism and social democracy. See, the whole communist system is based on deception.
There really is an elitist system with a ruling elite and everybody else enslaved. There really is no communism or true socialism there, is it? Other than under socialism, everything's owned by the government, and that, of course, is this ruling elite.
Yeah, and actually, I think the best description is one that Jack Ziak has used in describing the Soviet Union as basically a counterintelligence state. Everybody watches everybody else, and it's like an organized crime operation with counterintelligence right at the top of the list. And this is the environment within which you operate. And in addition to this, the entire ideology, you know, 95% of it, is all deception designed to entrap people. And most of the people I've talked to who have defected from over there really didn't even understand that. It was just that Sena knew it because he was so high in the system and so sensitive to the politics.
All right, fine. So let's then get into the men we left behind in the First World War. And, of course, the general defector of the United States was debriefed by our intelligence officers, but, of course, they didn't want to hear what he had to say about the men we had abandoned. This wasn't popular, and certainly the last thing they ever wanted was for the American people to know what had really happened to our prisoners of war. So why don't you sort of give us the story? What happened in the First World War? What happened in the Second World War? And then, of course, the things that Major General Senya really understood was Korea and at least part of Vietnam.
Well, of course, the whole thing started really in the First World War, and we had men over there that were fighting basically alongside of the Russians, and then the regime changed, and all of a sudden they started capturing our men and putting them in their gulag. And after the war, they denied they even had the men.
Now, these were the Americans who went to Murmansk to bring the supplies in?
Yes, and to Archangel, I guess it was.
Right.
And what's known as the Expeditionary Forces. And then there were also a number of men that came over in the railway crew, which was then an army operation to get the trains moving in Russia. We had a lot of different ways in which we were coming over there, and most of the time it was to help Russia.
Yeah, exactly. I know a lot of the people who went to work at the Ford plant at Gorky in Russia were eventually arrested and sent off to Siberia. These were Americans, And our government did absolutely nothing about it, nor did Henry Ford.
That's right. And when they had their famine that started in 1920, they asked for food and medical supplies and assistance from the United States. And for the first time and only time, the United States tended to exercise a little discretion, said, well, we won't give you any food unless you give us back our prisoners. And all of a sudden, they decided that they would release the prisoners they didn't have, which they started to do as we started shipments of supplies over. But the minute our shipments started, they stopped releasing prisoners. And that's where we should have reacted and stopped the supply, but we didn't.
Yeah, in fact, it's just so reminiscent of what happened recently. Apparently, some at least a year ago, we suddenly realized that the North Koreans had violated their promise not to develop a thermonuclear bomb, a nuclear bomb. And, of course, we had, in 1994, we had arrived at an agreement with them. We would give them all sorts of free fuel oil, and we would build a water nuclear plant for them that didn't generate plutonium. When we found out, of course, that they were violating their agreement and had actually just about completed a nuclear bomb, if not completed it, instead of cutting off the supplies, we continued giving them free fuel oil paid for by the American taxpayers, continued working to build that plutonium plant. You sort of wonder, what should the mentality be, you know, that you would be so intent upon financing and helping the communists, despite the fact that they don't live up to their agreements. And, of course, that held true to the men that were in the Soviet prison camps during the First World War. And when it didn't matter that they had stopped releasing them in, we still gave them massive amounts of food, which is the only thing that stabilized the communist regime at that time. 97% of the food we gave to Russia went to the communists, 3% to the anti-communists. That comes from Herbert Hoover's memoirs and is quoted in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. So, you know, so how many men died, do you think, in the gulag?
Well, we lost at least 3,000 people from World War One and from World War Two. They kept upwards of 20,000 people.
But of course, the American people never heard this.
No, of course, particularly World War Two, because Uncle Joe was our best uncle. I mean, he was put forth as just a wonderful individual and somebody that any kid would just like to have in the neighborhood. Of course, he's one of the most evil characters of the century. But that's the way it goes. You know, we have never learned that you can't negotiate with the devil. And that's what we've been trying to do. And people just don't get the message. And, of course, the message is that's irrelevant when you're trying to build a new world order.
Amen to that. So then eventually, of course, we just sort of wrote these men off. There were, of course, families were concerned about it, but that information was totally suppressed. And Dr. Douglas brings that out in his book. We actually offer a report that came out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee from Senator Jesse Helms, beautifully documenting all these things and totally ignored by the controlled media, because the last thing they want is for the American people and specifically for the military to realize how we have betrayed our fighting men again and again and again.
That's true. Of course, if people start recognizing what they really mean to the commander-in-chief and to the political people in Washington, why would anybody want to go to war? Why would anybody want to even enlist in the military? Our general idea is, well, you never leave a fellow serviceman behind. That's a point of honor. Yet that has never been withheld by our own top people in command. It's really a crying shame, but that's the way it is. That's, you know, that's one of the hardest things to come to grips with, is the deceit and duplicity of our own national leaders. And indeed, about the only person that really seemed to recognize that on the Senate Select Committee from 1992 was Herb Kohl, who basically said that the government did not keep its promises to those who served in Vietnam, and that the evidence that he saw indicates that the same thing is true with respect to those who served in World War II, the Korean War, and the Cold War as well. One of the few people to really recognize that.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. I mean, we're all horrified with the use of this poison gas in the theater over in Russia, and I think 117 people died. And one of those who died of the hostages died of the poison gas. And, you know, what a terrible thing to have done. But people have forgotten we used dioxin, Agent Orange, in Vietnam, and many of our soldiers had permanent results, residual from that. And it was denied and denied and denied. Only recently have we found that we used sarin gas on our own men back in the 1950s and 1960s. On our ships, we actually gassed our own ships just to see what would happen. We know that 200,000 of our Gulf War veterans, young men who went overseas to fight for our country, and of course they've come back, and 200,000 of them now have registered as having permanent sequelae and symptoms of Gulf War illness, and they can't get any treatment at all from the Veterans Administration. They're just being told that it's all in your head. 200,000 crazy people came back from the war, and interestingly enough, the same thing happened to the British soldiers and soldiers in other countries who were there. There was something that happened that, and of course many people think it was the vaccines that were given, but be that as it may, we see this the same pattern, the use of our troops for experiments over and over and over again. Well, let's talk a little bit then about what happened in Korea, because that was certainly the part that you learned the most about from Major General Senya. Yes. And of course, there were about 8,000 American boys who were betrayed, who were abandoned by our government at the end of the Korean War. Young men who went overseas to fight for America and ended up being betrayed by their government.
That's true. And several thousand of those met their death not in slave labor camps, but in experimental hospitals where they were operated on and used as guinea pigs to test chemical and biological warfare agents.
But that was done by the Russians or by the Czechs?
This is done by both the Russians and the Czechs. The North Koreans actually provided security around the facilities, but that's about all. This was really not a North Korean operation. As a matter of fact, the whole war was really not a North Korean operation. The Czechs got their instructions to build the hospitals over there months before the war started, and we now find out that nearly all the planes were not North Korean pilots, but Soviet pilots. The Soviets really ran the war. And, of course, they had all their stooges in North Korea in all the key positions of leadership. And it was really a Soviet war that we sort of invited in with the statements that came out of the White House and the State Department.
Well, I think that there's so many things about the Korean War. For those of you who have never read General MacArthur's reminiscences, one of the most devastating things he brings out is the fact that the American 7th Fleet was stationed between Taiwan and the mainland, not to protect Taiwan from the Chinese communists, but to protect the Chinese communists from the Taiwanese army, but by now had military supplies, and we had allowed them to arm and organize. And so by placing the American fleet between Taiwan and the mainland, that freed up a million-man Chinese communist army to go to Manchuria, to come down that into North Korea to kill our boys. And, of course, the Chinese communists had to know that we would not pull the fleet out, because that would have left their coast essentially unguarded and made them vulnerable to a counterattack from Taiwan. So there were obviously agreements between our government and the upper echelon of the Chinese communist government that would protect them. And the same thing General Lin Piao is quoted as saying, and this is by General MacArthur in his book Reminiscences, "Everybody who loves freedom should read it." Lin Piao, who headed the million-man army, said, "I would never have risked my troops and my military reputation and brought my men across the Yalu if I had not been guaranteed that Washington would restrain General MacArthur from taking retaliatory measures against my lines of supply." So obviously there were secret agreements made ahead of time, and of course General MacArthur, the American military, was never allowed to know that the highest echelons of our government were working and had some sort of an agreement behind the scenes. And General MacArthur was horrified when he realized that the Chinese communists knew things about our policy that he was never allowed to know. So what happened to those 8,000 men? And could you perhaps tell us what happened to those that were utilized then for experiments in North Korea, and then what happened to the others?
Certainly. There were some that, of course, were just used as slave labor and may still be alive, some of them, in North Korea. probably the majority, several thousand, were shipped over to the Soviet Union by the train load to go to labor camps and particularly uranium mines. But then there were several thousand that were sent to these hospitals that the Czechs built. And they were there to be experimented upon by the Russian and the Czech doctors. And they really valued the American prisoners of war because they were testing chemical and biological agents, among other things, and they wanted to see how those agents would be affected, would affect the Americans, of course, who have a different medical history from the South Koreans or the North Koreans. And they used them to test the chemical and the biological things. They also started their testing on radiation. They would bring radioactive sources into the country from Russia and use that to irradiate various parts of the body, different organs, to see what would happen to them. They also employed something that's rather ghastly, which was a psychological and physiological stress, which is another way of looking at torture. And the object was really to see what was the limit that the Americans could withstand relative to other people. Because of this, they felt was critical to know as an indication of how well we could stand up to the rigors of nuclear war. Now, one of the very curious things that began in Korea was the testing of new mind control drugs. These were drugs that were really designed to try and influence behavior and mental attitudes, coupled, of course, with psychological operations. A typical example was, you may remember the various newsreels where they showed Americans being interviewed, soldiers in North Korea, and they were talking about, they were really deprecating the whole life in the United States and talking about how wonderful it was under the North Korean communism. And the fact of the matter was, these confessions, so-called, were really obtained via the use of the first generation of the mind control drugs that the Soviets were hard at work at. Of course, these were the drugs and these were the experiments that gave rise to what became known as MKUltra, which was the CIA's program, which also involved a lot of experiments on humans without their knowledge, particularly LSD in the United States, and other chemicals on prisoners in Europe and in Japan and in Korea and elsewhere.
And, of course, a lot of these experiments were carried out in Canada without the knowledge of the people. And, of course, they sort of justified that by saying, well, the wicked communists have that, so we noble people will have to, of course, do these experiments so we can keep up with the wicked communists. And then they used them on people without their knowledge or consent right here in the United States.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, there's a memo that I quote in InBetrayed, which is a... It was written by Richard Helms, where he was saying that they really needed to get more human testing because they were falling behind the Soviets in their knowledge of the various potentials of these different drugs.
All right, fine. So, of course, now I understand, though, that they were doing even human dissections on our servicemen without anesthesia while they were alive.
That's true. They used a lot of the POWs just as specimens to test operations, and that gave some of the young doctors a field experience in a typical thing was amputations. They would cut off arms and legs just for practice and without any painkillers or anything. One of the things that Sainer recalls that when we talked was that they would often just cut off legs and then just wait and watch and see what happened and how long it took the men to die. Now, he had one of the people working for him who was the legal advisor to the doctors over in the Korean hospitals. This was Colonel Bartok. And he got talking about these experiments with Bartok because this was the time that the Soviets had come, in 1957, wanting the use of Czech doctors and further experiments on prisoners in the Soviet Union. And so Sainer was talking with Bartok to gain his experience from the war over North Korea, where Bartok was at the time, and he talked about the experiments and how horrible they were. And he says, you know, the boys that were there, and he referred to them as boys, he said they screamed day and night. And he would go to the Russians to try and get something to give them, and the Russian, head of the Russian intelligence over there said basically, they should have screened before they came here. Now it is too late. One time he was going over trying to get some medications, and he says, why waste it on the Americans? They're only going to be dead in a day or two. It was the screaming that really got to him also. Sana recalled this. He became quite filled emotionally when he was describing to me. He said that, that Bartok got... he would just sort of sit in front of him on the chair in his desk, and he would hold his head in his hands, and he would start mumbling. He said, scream, 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 and nothing to do, nothing to do. And he just sort of rocked back and forth in his chair, and just went over and over in his mind. He also complained to Sana about the mind control drugs. And he said, you know, there were all these 19- and 20-year-old boys whose minds had just been destroyed by the drugs. You know, they didn't know who they were, where they were, or why. In the case of the officers, he described how they, you know, they tried to change their personalities with drugs, and after those had been destroyed, they would just continue the research on other parts of their bodies with the chemical and the biological agents until there was nothing left. And then when they were of no further use, they just killed them and put them into the crematorium, which the Czechs also had built so as to dispose of the bodies. It was a very gruesome operation from
But of course, our government had to know what was going on with our intelligence and did absolutely nothing about it, rather than us say, you know, you stop that, we're coming back in again, we're going to cut off all aid, you know, we're not going to allow you to do that to our boys. They were simply written off by our leaders. That is what's so unconscionable.
There's no question. They all knew throughout the process of the types of condition the boys would be subjected to. In this particular case, as a matter of fact, that Colonel Phil Corso testified to the Dornum Subcommittee in 1996 about their knowledge. And he was in on the intelligence staff of the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet during the Korean War, and then later he actually was on the Panmunjom staff during the negotiations. He had access to all the intelligence, and he was questioned after Hosanna had testified if he had known anything about these experiments. And he said, absolutely. He said, they were gruesome. They were worse than anything they'd heard about from the Nazis. And he sent out patrols to try and find out more about what was happening. He said, but he could never learn other than the fact that they were taking place and there were these hospitals that were very secret, but his men just couldn't get close to them. So they did know about these experiments and what was happening, and yet they just sacrificed the boys. And
we're going to have to just interrupt you there, and we'll be back in just 3 minutes with Dr. Joseph Douglas, and we'll take your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you are out there in the listening audience and you are concerned about what's going on, if you're concerned about the material you hear on Radio Liberty, and you'd like to help us as we try to get the truth out across America, the truth that you're not going to get from the major media, why, we hope many of you will decide right now to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And, of course, on radio, internet, shortwave, satellite, we are having an increasing effect across America. In fact, our programs are now heard on over 50 outlets across America every single week, and many of them just half an hour a week. But, you know, at least it's being heard. I think our Saturday program is heard on pretty close to 40 different stations, and hopefully we're going to be able to continue doing that. But certainly the important thing is we are having an outreach, and we hope that many of you will want to partner with us if you are interested. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then let me remind you about our website. It's www.radioliberty.com. And you can go there and you can pull down my newsletters and you can pull down much of the material we've written and my material on the Georgie Guidestones, those occult monuments there, or that occult monument, which is in Elberton, Georgia. our treatise on population control. But the major thing with BMI, our programs, many of them are archived. You can listen 5 hours a day live, either directly to Radio Liberty, or you can certainly link to our other programs on the other networks, American Freedom Network and Genesis Network. And then, of course, invite you to pull down our newsletters, read them, copy them, and help us to get the material out across America. And then, of course, we want to mention that we are putting on a full-day seminar on the 23rd of November. That's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we're going to have a number of speakers there. We're going to talk about what you must do to prepare for the times that lie ahead. We're going to have some very difficult times. Today, they're now talking now about the necessity of mobilize about 250,000 National Guardsmen. If we attack Iraq, and of course they'll be used to guard our power plants, to guard our facilities all across America, because they fear, and rightly so, that if we attack Iraq, a preemptive strike, because they might build some nuclear weapons. We know the North Koreans already have them, but the Iraqis might build them at some time, that there might be retaliation by the Muslims that we brought into this country. In fact, after the Gulf War, we brought in somewhere between 3,500 and 8,000 of Saddam Hussein's Republic Guard, the people loyal to Saddam Hussein, and allowed them to settle here. Why would we do something like that? And, of course, would it be possible that if we were to be attacking Iraq, that some of those people that we brought into the country back in 1991, and we know that some of them would appear have been involved in the bombing of the Murrah Building in 1995, but, of course, that has been kept from the American people. We wouldn't want them to think it was anybody besides Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, and you want to get into that. You need to hear my interviews with Bob Bickle, who has been investigating this as a professional investigator. There's no question at all there was an Islamic involvement there, but then after all, if the American people had known in 1995 what had really happened, the American people might have demanded we do something about the Islamic connection and the connection between the bombing of the Murrah Building and the people working with Osama bin Laden. And if we'd done it then, we probably wouldn't have had September 11th. We wouldn't have had the justification for going to war with Afghanistan and now with Iraq. Had we done what was right at that time, we would not be moving, I think, into a disastrous situation. Well, I say this only to say I think we're moving to some very, very difficult times financially, because if you see what's happening in the market or our economy and the markets throughout the world, why the whole world is going into a downturn. And how are you going to prepare yourself, especially if we see the undermining and the destruction of the value of the American currency, which is, at least according to George Soros, very, very likely. He's already talking about our currency losing a third of its value, and that is if we don't go into a recession. And if we go into a recession, he said, it could lose a great deal more of its value. Well, you need to know how to begin to position yourself financially, spiritually, fiscally, and we're going to cover all of those things health-wise at this coming meeting. So that's going to be on November the 23rd here in the Monterey Bay area. We hope many of you will come from other areas, or certainly if you live in Northern California, we hope that you'll be there. There's going to be all day long. There's going to be a luncheon. If you're interested in coming, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we have to know how many luncheons are there going to be, so we need to have an idea how many people are going to be there. Again, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, if you're interested in coming to the luncheon and to the all-day seminar. And again, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Joe Douglas. We're talking about his book, Betrayed, and if you're interested in learning anything more about that, why, of course, you could always call our 800 number. They could give you a suggested donation for Betrayed, Dr. Douglas' story of the men we were abandoned during the wars of the last century. So there were about 8,000 American boys. Many of them were simply used as guinea pigs, human guinea pigs in North Korea, and our government knew about it, did absolutely nothing about it. And of course, thousands of them were sent off to Siberia, where many of them died. And is there any possibility that any of them might still be alive, do you think, Dr. Douglas?
Oh, I think so, yes. It's hard to separate out the different wars to know who was still alive, but if you look at the Korean War, there's about something like around 15 or so South Koreans who were captured during that war who recently escaped, or were allowed to escape, I should say. And the South Korean government estimates there are something like 350 more South Korean prisoners in North Korea. One of the people who actually speaks Korean, who was in the POW search office, has gone over there and talked to a lot of people, and he made an estimate that he felt that there were at least about 15 Americans alive, and that it could be as high as 150 still held captive, not all from the Korean War, some from the Vietnam War, but still over there held by the North Korean government. There's been some discussions going on about live sightings and similar types of reports, but of course, as you know, the government, our government, doesn't want to see any live POWs, because then the people would know that they'd actually been left behind and abandoned by the government.
And so they will do everything they can to keep them from coming back. See, that is the thing. We do not want them back. In fact, when Boris Yeltsin offered to actually help us find out how many Americans there were, why don't you tell that story? Because I think it's such an important story. This was after Yeltsin had just come to power, and he was coming to the United States. What was that story about?
Yeah, this was shortly after the Helms report was having its impact that you described before. And Helms sponsored a letter that was signed by, I think, about 47 other senators. And it went over to Yeltsin and said, we want our prisoners back. And if we don't get them or get some interest in your part in helping us, we won't be similarly disinclined to be sending money over to you. And so he came over looking for money, and I think this was April or May 1991, as I recall, and he started talking on the plane about, well, yes, he thought that there were probably some people that got moved over from Vietnam, and that we ought to work together to find them. And when that started getting reported, the position of the administration was to try and kill it. The first thing they did is they said, well, Yeltsin has a drinking problem, and he was drunk, didn't know what he's talking about. And that was certainly soon proved false, and then they shifted and they said, well, the translations weren't right. And they checked all the translations, and they were absolutely right. And then finally they said, well, they sent people over to work with Yeltsin's people to redraft his speech so that what he said basically was, well, we want to cooperate in trying to find people, because the one thing that Bush wanted was he wanted examples that the Russians and the Americans were cooperating, so that the American people wouldn't be worried about all these things we were going to be sending over to Russia. At the same time, the final thing, the straw that broke the camel's back, I think, for most people's understanding of this problem, was what Kurt Weldon told us. And Kurt Weldon is the House of Representatives, and he speaks Russian. And in about 1997, he reported to the media how he had been over in Russia talking to friends of his in the Duma, and they expressed their concern to him because they said, you know, what's this? You know, we've had a State Department, your State Department representative, coming over here and telling us that you don't want any help finding missing American prisoners of war. Of course, that's the example of precisely what you're talking about, Dr. Stan. They don't want, our people don't want to find live American prisoners of war.
And of course, I think people have to understand that our State Department is always controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations. The Secretary of State literally always comes from the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the American extension of a British organization, which was created back in 1891 by Cecil John Rhodes. And if you want to check that out, Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, pages 951 and 952, tells where the CFR came from. So it doesn't matter whether the Democrats or Republicans are there. The same policies always continue. And, of course, that we have no intention of ever trying to bring those boys home. But, of course, we can't tell the families that. And we certainly can't tell the American people that, of course, our leaders have consistently betrayed American fighting men. Or we might not have any fighting men. They're out until we get rid of these people. Would you really want to send your son to fight in another country, realizing that although his buddies would not leave him behind, that their government officials would, and then they do everything they could to cover up the fact that they've been left to die on foreign soil. I think a lot of people are willing to die for their country, but they're not willing to have their country betray them. Well, then what about Vietnam? What's the story there?
Well, Vietnam was pretty well a repeat of Korea with one big exception. That's in Vietnam. The Vietnamese wanted to do the operations and just have the Czechs and the Soviet doctors as advisors. And this caused a lot of problems to the Soviets because the Vietnamese weren't skilled. They really didn't care that much about medicine. As a matter of fact, they were very crude. And I think one of the people that explained it best was one of the Czech doctors who was talking to Sena during their negotiations with some of the North Vietnamese when they were over to Czechoslovakia, and he said, you know, the whole operation was just very primitive, and you couldn't look at it any other way. He said that, you know, the Vietnamese hate the Americans so much that they make as much pain as is possible in conducting surgery. And, of course, they were doing the same types of things, you know, cutting off arms and legs just for practice, and even cutting in and taking parts of the organs out to see what would happen to the Americans. When they would do this, they'd make as much pain as they possibly could, even if they were just giving an injection of a drug. And, Dr. Durbel told Sainey, he said, you know, we know it's war, but there should be some ethics. We hired doctors after all, he said, but over there, there is no ethic. They have no regard for the human body or pain. They make as much pain as is possible. And, you know, there were a lot of negotiations around this point, which I described in the book, where they had a hard time working with the North Vietnamese who just didn't understand medicine. And they didn't understand why the Soviets cared how they treated the prisoners. And, of course, the Soviets wanted healthy specimens. And they even offered to send over food so that they would not be starved when they got them. And they also took a lot of haggling, but they finally negotiated to give the Vietnamese guards medical exams so as anyone that were sick or had rare diseases could be excluded from guarding these prisoners that were valuable and whom the Soviets did not want to get with a bunch of oriental diseases when they were shipped to the Soviet Union.
All right, well, let's go to Joan Paris, who's calling in. Hi, Joan. How are you doing?
Great. Good evening. I just wanted to verify. I was just listening to a bit of the program and listening to you say that there were still survivors in Siberia. And I have a brother who's now a pastor, but he was a missionary for a number of years, and he was able to go into Russia. I don't know how long ago they opened it up, but a couple of years maybe after that. And I think he was there maybe 15 years ago, and he did get to go into Siberia, and I remember him telling us that he encountered, and I don't know if it was one or more than one, men that just seemed really, really old and decrepit, that they had had a really hard life. But I believe this man was an American, and he had been a prisoner, and they'd just been left there. And some of them were just, you know, allowed to, the ones that had survived were allowed to live there, but they had just had a horribly, horribly hard life. But there are, or there were at that time, still people living that had been Americans.
And it is so sad to realize they were betrayed by their government. But then when you realize the spiritual forces that energized the people who took control of our government, it all makes sense.
Yes.
Anything else you want to say, Joan?
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you for adding that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that certainly supports everything I've learned. There's a number of people who were in the gulags also who came out and reported on seeing American prisoners in the gulags where they were. And indeed, there was a report that went over to Russia about 2 years ago, as I recall, from our own office in the Pentagon wanting information on over 100 names, as I recall, of live sightings that they'd identified from various people talking about Americans in the Gulag. So there's good reason to believe there's a lot of people in North Korea, in Vietnam, in Laos, and in Russia.
Now, well, actually, we carry a book called Out of the Ice by Herman Dinsmore, and it's one of the most gripping stories. He was his father had gone to Russia to work in the plant at Gorky, the Ford Motor plant, after, I guess it was the First World War when they first set that up. And he was there, of course, and eventually he was taken off to a Soviet prison camp and described all the Americans he saw there, just the most gripping stories, called Out of the Ice by Herman Dinsmore. And really, it's a book that everybody who loves freedom should read. And then you ask yourself, why would our government finance such a brutal, brutal, brutal regime? And yet, of course, we have financed them since their inception. Anybody who doubts that really should read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. But Dr. Douglas, of course, as you analyze this, why is it that our leaders refuse to acknowledge the truth? And there have been people working certainly within this unit, within the military, who've recognized what's happened and tried to get the word out, haven't there?
Yes, there's one person in particular, Colonel Mellard Peck, and he was a special forces officer, Green Beret, with I think two Distinguished Service Cross awards, and he took over the POW MIA office in the Defense Intelligence Agency in 1989. And in 1991, he wrote a resignation letter in protest of the way in which the office was being run. And he took his dagger and he stabbed the message to the wall, and he left, and he never returned. And you know, he said some. He really is probably the person that best described the whole POW-MIA effort, and I've reproduced his memo in total in one of the appendices, and it's also in that Senate report that you mentioned. But he says that the effort to address prisoners of war is a national travesty, that it just isn't happening, that the government players were all interested just in conducting a damage-limiting exercise.
In other words, damage, don't let the American people know the truth, is that it?
Oh, absolutely. And the idea, as he described it, I think, was very good. He says any soldier left in Vietnam, even inadvertently, was in fact abandoned years ago, and that the farce that is being played is no more than political legerdemain done with smoke and mirrors to stall the issue until it dies a natural death. And that tells the story right there.
Well, I think that that's what it's all about. Don't let the American people know. Pretend that you're really trying to do something, you know, placate the families of the men we've abandoned and betrayed. Always give them the impression that, oh, if you make a fuss, why we still have these ongoing negotiations, you're just going to endanger the lives of your loved ones. Just be quiet and wait. And wait, and wait. And of course, people have been waiting now since the Korean War, and I'm sure there are even some people who are still waiting from the Second World War.
That's true. And you know, that office spends $100 million a year, roughly. And what they do is they're only interested in collecting bones. The last thing they'd want to do would be do anything effective to try and find alive POWs. And not only that, but the biggest farce of the whole thing, Dr. Stan, is they expect to find these people through cooperative efforts. Now, you can just imagine, you know, trying to accomplish something in a cooperative effort with the Soviet intelligence service, the KGB, when it's clear that cooperation would mean revealing the whole nature of the war crimes and atrocities that the Soviets have been conducting for 80 years. I mean, it just won't happen. It's not about to happen. But it does give this illusion of progress. It is designed to deceive not the Soviets, but the American people. And to, as Colonel Peck says, to mislead everybody until the problem dies a natural death.
Well, of course, it's, you know, in my opening of my program, it's always reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And, of course, that's really what it's all about. It's creating this illusion to give the American people the feeling that we're really trying to do something. Or we would never abandon American boys. And yet, of course, it almost appears to be official government policy. And, you know, as now we enter this war, new war, Third World War, call it the Fourth World War, call it what you will, we're going to war in the Middle East, and is this just going to stop with Iraq? Is it going to involve Iran or Syria or Saudi Arabia? When you start a war, you never know when it's going to end, and this is really what worries me. And
that's
how
right.
many American boys from this war will be betrayed and will spend the rest of their lives in a dungeon someplace, as apparently we've done with Commander Spiker, the naval officer who was shot down during the Gulf War. And written off immediately and only recent to be reclassified as the missing in action after the family raised such a ruckus. And there was so much evidence there that obviously he had been captured by the Iraqis, and our government didn't want either the American people or the family to know that.
Well, there's a couple of problems that also enter in with Iraq, one being that this time it looks like Iraq will fight. And when you start to go into the cities, you get into the worst type of fighting imaginable, and especially if you're going to try and to go into underground facilities, which is where the things they're looking for are, and there's going to be an awful lot of casualties.
And I think the interesting thing is Saddam is giving his people rifles. Now, I think that the Iraqi people hate Saddam Hussein. I fear that they hate America more than they hate Saddam Hussein, and I would hope that, of course, they would turn the rifles on the Iraqi army and the Republican Guard. But obviously Saddam Hussein, who is no fool, he may be a wicked, evil man, but he's no fool, and if he's arming his own people for fights within the cities, it could very well be that we will have a living nightmare over there. If he didn't think his people would fight, that they hate America more than they hate him, or that they resent America more than they resent him, then there's no way he would be arming his people.
No, well, you can also imagine sending Americans into any of those cities. A city is a death trap, particularly if you're talking about the dispersal of chemical or biological agents, which can be done in such a way that it's cheap, no munitions are involved, you just release the stuff out a window when some people are coming by, and they would have to be prepared to cope with that at every corner, every window, every building they pass through. And not only that, when you start doing that, when it gets hot, and it gets awful hot in Iraq, and there's no way that you can be maneuvering in chemical or biological warfare protection garb, not to mention the fact that those uniforms they have had tremendous technical problems going back 20 years.
And, of course, the other thing is, of course, the Russians have been supplying the Iraqis in violation of all the rules and regulations and, embargoes. The Russians don't abide by that any more than the Iraqis do. Our good friends, Mr. Putin, I wonder if he gave the Iraqis some of that same gas that they used in the theater in Moscow where they killed 117 of the hostages. I mean,
that should not have been any surprise to our authorities. For two reasons. Number one, the Russians were interested in stopping the people, as we call them, the guerrillas over there, and the Russians had never had any concern about their own people. I mean, they killed 60 million of their own people in the past century. So, worrying about protecting the hostages is just not going to happen.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is this whole war, this whole Chechen war, really came about after somebody blew up three apartment buildings in Moscow. And, of course, most people over there believe that Putin blew them up, or the KGB blew them up, to justify the war. And people say, why, what a terrible thing to do. Why should we be surprised that they would create an incident to justify a war? And, of course, that's a frightening thing to contemplate, that people would be that crashed and indifferent to human suffering. They would blow up three apartment houses and kill I don't know how many Russians just to justify going to war in Chechnya. And of course, would anybody else be willing to create incidents in that similar manner?
No, and, the sleeping gas is very interesting because we encountered that before in Afghanistan. In 1979, 80, 81, the Russians were using that in a addition to some other biological chemical agents. Glanders is one of the suspected agents that was used. But this gas was so effective that when we would move in, we would find soldiers that were in positions to fire rifles, and they were dead.
And, of course, this was when our CIA-backed units were going in there, is that it?
Yes. And this sleeping gas, or whatever it was that they were using back then, was so effective that it just overcame people before they ever knew what was happening. And
of course, that's against all international law, but then why should we be surprised? We backed Saddam Hussein when he was using poison gas on his own people and on the Iranians. Well, we're out of time, Dr. Douglas. We could go on for another hour, but I'm going to have to let you go. It's getting late back there. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless you.
Good night.
All right. That's Dr. Joe Douglas and his book, Is Betrayed, and if you'd like to know anything more about it, you could call 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the suggested donation. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. Pray for the boys that are going to Iraq. Pray the American people may understand the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged. Pray for revival in America. And lastly, please pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. So until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye. May the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, this evening on the line with us is Dr. R.L. Heimers, Jr. And, of course, we're going to be talking about two books he wrote. One is called Left Behind. The other is called A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation. Now, the idea of Left Behind, of course, everybody equates that with Tim LaHaye, but Dr. Heimers has written a book giving basically the same concept. Of course, he's not talking about the non-Christians who pardon me, about the Christians who are taken up in the rapture. He's talking about the people who consider themselves Christians who are left behind, and points out in his book that certainly many of our evangelical leaders feel that so many people going to churches today, and even many ministers, when the time comes for our Lord's return, will be identified as people who hold a false faith, who's you know, may profess to be Christians, but there'd never be enough evidence to convict them if they were ever accused of being a Christian. Dr. Heimers, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yes, it's good to be here. The book is actually The Church That Will Be Left Behind.
The Church That Will Be Left Behind. Well, I've read about half of it, and I couldn't find the book tonight, but why don't you just sort of develop that idea? Because it's sort of an unusual thought. That, you know, most people think everybody's going to be raptured immediately when the rapture comes, but you feel that there are an awful lot of people who are, and even a large part of the church, will not be raptured.
Yes, I think that my basic view is the same as Tim LaHaye. I believe in the rapture. I believe it's followed by the seven-year tribulation and with the Antichrist and all of that. But I think that we've made a basic mistake in thinking that most people are going to be raptured. About 75% of the American people claim to be born again, but this doesn't really hold up under scrutiny, and many of our evangelical leaders and fundamental Christian leaders are now saying that that really most of these people are not really converted. Back in the 1940s, Bob Jones Sr., who was a great evangelist back then, said that he felt that 50% of the church members were unconverted. B.R. Lakin, who often spoke on Jerry Falwell's Old Time Gospel Hour, said that he thought that 75% of those in Bible-believing churches were not converted. W.A. Criswell, whom I knew personally, pastor of the First Baptist Church at Dallas, the largest Southern Baptist church in America, said that he'd be surprised if 25% of his members made it to heaven. And I've just been reading A.W. Tozier. Tozier was considered a 20th century prophet. Tozier thought that 90% had never really experienced the new birth. This is corroborated by many others. Louis Palau, I just was reading what Louis Palau said, a famous evangelist, along that same line. So many people that I talk to, Dr. Monteith, feel that it was like, sort of like me when I was a kid. Somebody took me to a Baptist church. I was 13 years old. I'd gone to a Catholic church a number of times, but they took me to this Baptist church. It was my first time there, and they had a son that was my age. It was the people next door, and they took me to church, and it was an evangelistic meeting. I went forward, and they took me in the other room and counseled me a little bit. And the next night I went back and they baptized me. That's the way I became a Baptist. I had no thought. Nobody counseled me. Nobody spoke to me. I thought I was a Christian. And I went for 7 years like that, and trying to live the Christian life and just miserable all the time. And when I was 20 years old, I experienced a real conversion while I was attending Bible school. There's all the difference in the world. We saw a movie last night on Luther. Martin Luther went through a similar kind of experience of trying so very hard to be a Christian and not able to do it, and then experiencing true conversion in Christ. And there's all the difference in the world. My feeling and research and talking to people is that the average evangelical doesn't really know what it means to be born again and will not be ready for the rapture. And that's really what the book is about, The Church That Will Be Left Behind.
Well, that's really a rather frightening thought, I think, most, and it's a rather shocking thought to most people who of course, feel that they're Christians. But, you know, unless there's really a transformation in your life, you're really not converted. If you are not a different person after your conversion than you were before, you know, then, of course, then this is all smoke and mirrors, but a symbolism over substance, but no reality.
And what the book does, Dr. Monteith, is the basic text of the book is 2 Thessalonians 2:3. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, comma, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. That is the Antichrist. So 2 Thessalonians 2:3 tells us that there will be a falling away, and the Greek that's translated falling away there is he apostasia. It means a departure from the faith. And I've traced this back through in several of my books, and it's in The Church That Will Be Left Behind as well, that I believe this falling away began in the 19th century with the ministry of Charles G. Finney. Now, when you mention Finney, most people think, and when I criticize him, people think, wow, that was the man that brought revival to America. But actually, what Finney did was he came along at the end of the Second Great Awakening, at the very end of it, and his practices, when he got through in New York, they called that area the Burned Out District. And that was the first part of America that went liberal. The Unitarians came in, and the liberals and the churches were eaten alive right after Finney's move through there. In the Third Great Awakening, in 1859, Finney was already an elderly man and held no part in that revival. So these ideas that Finney brought revival to America are not really true at all. What he did was he introduced a form of Pelagianism. By that I mean a works righteousness, in which he substituted a superficial decision for Christ for the older view of the Puritans and Wesleyans of conversion. And the church is filled up with people who were unconverted as a result of changing, and it's a very remarkable change. Perhaps the best book that a person could read on that is a book by Ian Murray called The Making and Marring of American Evangelicalism. It's called Revival and Revivalism, The Making and Marring of American Evangelicalism, 1750 to 1858. And Murray points out that this began with the ministry of Finney, in which before that, pastors took great care to make sure that people understood the plan of salvation and that they really understood that they were sinners and that they really were converted. They took great, great care in that. In both the Wesleyan and the Puritan churches, in the Arminian and the Calvinistic churches. But after Finney, it increasingly became the standard that if a person raised their hand or came forward, that outward significant, that outward show was the proof of the inward conversion, and to the place where they've come in many places to just baptizing people the way I was when they come forward without talking to them at all. And I think this is a great tragedy. It reminds me of what happened after Constantine gave the decree that allowed Christianity to be a religion in the realm. So many people wanted to become Christians that they marched them by, and the bishops would take a palm branch and just sprinkle them with water as hundreds of people came by in front of them, and they became nominal Christians. And many historians think that this was really a very harmful period in church history, when so many thousands of pagans became nominal Christians without being converted. And I think that something like that happened, especially toward the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, where so many people have come into the church and have become members of the church without truly experiencing Christ, that we have a situation today where we have evangelicals in the ascendancy. Just 2 years ago, you had a Southern Baptist president, Bill Clinton. You had a Southern Baptist vice president, Al Gore. You had a Southern Baptist leader of the House, Trent Lott, leader of the Senate, and all of them supposedly born again. And yet, during that period, I think America sank to its lowest moral level. So we're not, and really the worst place in the country, and this is really a shame because I'm a Baptist. I consider myself conservative, fundamental, evangelical. But the worst place for divorce in the entire nation is in the South. And the highest group that divorces are Baptists in the South. And that's a tragic statement. It shouldn't be, and I think it's rooted in the fact that so many people have become professing Christians without really knowing Jesus Christ. And that's what the book is about, the church that will be left behind. And we talk about how the apostasy came about and then what will happen at the rapture. And I think far fewer people are going to be raptured than most people realize. I think it'll be a very small number that will be raptured. And then afterwards, looking back, people are going to say, you know, the rapture came because the Antichrist will sign a peace treaty, Daniel 9:27, with Israel, and then the countdown of the 7 years of the tribulation begins, and people will begin to say, you know, we missed the boat, we missed out. And then that's what this book is really dealing with, what happens then after the tribulation, or in the tribulation, rather, itself, that so many people will be awakened and will find a real conversion. That's in Revelation chapter 7. You have 144,000 Jewish converts, and then you have an uncounted multitude of Gentile converts. So you have the greatest revival in the history of Christianity taking place in the tribulation. I believe that it's triggered by the fact that so many people will realize that they weren't truly converted when the rapture comes and they're left behind. That's the thesis of the book, The Church That Will Be Left Behind. I kind of went on there for a minute. But
well, the thing is that most people don't really feel that they need Christ today. I mean, after all, we have a wonderful, affluent society. We have stability. We don't have the chaos that exists in so many parts of the world. We supposedly have a representative government. There are probably no people in any time in all history that have had the affluence and the prosperity that we are experiencing here in America today. I mean, you go down to Kmart, you go down to Walmart, you can buy clothing and other things that is made by slave labor in other countries, and we don't have the rampant inflation that they've had in other countries. We live pretty well. Even the people who might be considered at poverty level here in the United States live far better than the vast majority of the people, even the middle class in many other countries.
So, yeah, that's true.
And, of course, the trouble is that most people don't realize that they do need God. That's the trouble.
That's right. You're exactly right. And even though we're tremendously affluent, as you said, there are warning signs. I just read in the paper a few days ago about this man that was found guilty of cruelty because he starved a guinea pig, and he was given 3 years in prison for cruelty to a guinea pig, to a rodent. And here at the same time, we have over 1 million babies killed every day, tortured and killed by abortion. 1,000 black children are killed every day by abortion. Abortion is the number one killer of black people. They stick needles in their brains. They rip their arms and legs off. They boil them alive in salt water. And they're many of them in the eighth and ninth month of life, thousands of them. And yet we are told that people have a, quote, constitutional right, unquote, to kill these children. And if a man kills a guinea pig, he gets 3 years in jail. But if he kills a baby, he's got a constitutional right. I was watching Phil Donahue for a few moments tonight and a few minutes on television, and I was looking at the people in the audience, and I thought, you know, this is not the America that I remember. I'm 61 years old, and I thought, look at these people. They look crazy. So many of the people, I thought, they look like Alfred E. Newman on the front of Mad Magazine, you know, the What Me Worry character with the tooth knocked out. And to me, you know, we are the greatest nation on earth, and there's no question about that, and we are an affluent society. But our people look pretty pretty crazy if you take a good look at them. And I think part of the reason is that we've had this cheap Christianity that hasn't converted many people. And people think that they're born again and they can just do whatever they want, live any way they want. And we've got to get, you know, in China, they're having a real revival right now. I was reading in the Orange County Register about the revival that's taking place in China. In one province, one-third of the people are now Christians, and those people undergo persecution and stand up for their faith in spite of persecution. And to me, you have some real Christianity going on there in China that we don't see very often here because we've made it too cheap, too easy, too simple, and the Christianity really hasn't affected us. Well, I think we're moving into a time, Dr. Monteith, when the days of American peace and prosperity are going to pass very quickly, and judgment is coming, and then it'll be tested whether people are real Christians or not. And when the rapture comes and the Antichrist comes and people are left behind, they're going to be looking for something. And this book gives, I think, the basic answer to it, and I hope that people will read it, The Church That Will Be Left Behind. You can also look at my website, which is www.rlhymersjr. It's just my name, rlhymersjr, that's junior at the end, .com. And I've got a lot of sermons and other articles on this subject as well.
And, of course, you've written several other books. One of them I have here is called A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation. And then, of course, the Demons in the Smoke, which is the a book, of course, that we first talked about. So, but you know, the thing is that one of the problems in our churches today is that there's no effort to convince us that we're sinners, that we need a Savior. In fact, message of the church seemed to have changed so dramatically. And, of course, you know, I see nothing wrong with, you know, people going to evangelical mission ministry and something touching their lives, but then you have to, you know, you can't just have that experience one time. You need to be instructed. You need to understand the tenets of the Scriptures, which is, of course, that we're all sinners, that we need a Savior, and the idea, of course, that never bothering to talk about sin anymore. Some of our ministers say that the worst thing you could ever do would be tell anybody they were sinners. It would hurt their self-esteem.
Yes,
it seems that we have changed the message of the Christian church so dramatically that I'm sure that, you know, if somebody were to come back from 100 years ago and go into one of our churches today, they wouldn't recognize the Christianity that's being taught. Do you think that's a part in the problems we're having?
Oh, that's a great part. You've got... got Schuller and his positive message, and he comes right out and says, I've got one of his books in my library where he calls it Self-Esteem, The New Reformation is the name of the book. Robert Schuller, he says the reformers were wrong, that man is not depraved and that he doesn't need to have a conversion experience. And so this is acceptable. Just raise your hand or just come forward the reformers were wrong. I think the reformers were right. And I believe that we need to get back to some of the things that were taught in the Protestant Reformation and in the First Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening and the Third Great Awakening. And I don't necessarily think, this is my own personal view, of course, I don't necessarily think that embracing the 5 points of Calvinism is the answer, because you can have a form of Calvinism which is doctrinal, but not experiential. The Wesleyans were not Calvinists, but they believed in a real conversion, and they believed they believed exactly the same as the Reformed people regarding conversion. And I think that we need to get back to some of this older teaching before the Finney movement came in and made it so light and so unimportant that it filled our churches, in my judgment, with lost people. You have the Presbyterian Church, and people wonder, what happened to the Protestant churches in our country? Well, the Methodists went first into liberalism. Then by 1900, there was a man named Munhall. that wrote a book. He was a Methodist minister, and he wrote a book, Breakers, Methodism Adrift. And it's a tremendous book. I get a copy of it, printed in 1900. He said Methodism has given up the new birth, and the churches are full of lost people. That was in 1900. The Presbyterians went second, and liberalism came into Princeton, and they defrocked J. Gresham Machen for standing up for the Bible. He was put out of the Presbyterian Church. And then the American Baptists and the Southern Baptists, so many of them, went that way. And people say, well, how did all this happen? Well, it happened by not insisting on a converted church membership. This is a tremendously interesting book. In 1903, a Baptist pastor named F.L. Chappell, C-H-A-P-E-L-L, F.L. Chappell, wrote a book called The Great Awakening of 1740. Now, he's writing about something that happened in the First Great Awakening.
That's Jonathan Edwards, of course.
Yes. The First Great Awakening, yes, with Edward. And he says, the dark days, and I'm quoting Chappell in his book written in 1903. He said, the dark days that preceded the Great Awakening will come again unless somebody stands firmly and clearly and decidedly by the doctrine of a converted church membership, unquote.
You know, I think that most Americans do not realize that in the almost 100 years, we're talking about almost 135 years, from the time when the Jamestown colony was first created in 1607 and then through the Pilgrims in 1620,
right.
You know, by the time you got around to 1730, we'd been around for 120 years or so.
Right,
and,
right.
Of course, by that time, Harvard, which was created, in 1647 to train Protestant ministers and to go out and to become ministers, it had been taken over by the liberals.
Yes.
Yale had been taken over pretty well, at least to some extent. So by 1830, America had become pretty much a depraved society.
Yes.
And this is what people really don't understand. It goes in cycles. You start out, you got tremendous dedication,
yes,
tremendous desire to serve the Lord, and the Puritans, the Huguenots, and the Quakers, and the Pilgrims were all here. They wanted to serve the Lord. They wanted to, and of course, we started as a Christian nation, and then by 1735, we were going just as we are going today.
And then you had Edwards, as you pointed out. And in England, you had Whitfield and Wesley, and you had this great awakening, and people came back.
And it was just a few men that changed the whole of England and the United States. In fact, had it not been for Whitfield and Wesley, why, probably England would have gone, France did in 1789, into a revolution.
Unquestionably.
Because Christianity had been reestablished in England at that time, 1740, 1750, then England had that bulwark against the revolutionary ferment that was sweeping Europe at the time.
And that's the thesis of the book, The Church That Will Be Left Behind, is that we've got to go back to what happened in the 1730s and 40s. We've got to go back, and we have to have another great awakening, because our churches are as dead as a doornail as they compared to what they should be. And in the day of Wesley and Whitfield and Edwards, they fired Edwards. Did you know that?
Yes.
He was fired from his church after he'd been there for, I think, about 30 years, because he insisted on the conversion of the children. And they actually fired this great man. He's considered the greatest philosopher that America's ever produced and one of the greatest theologians of all time. But he insisted on a real conversion. He saw this great revival, and yet they fired him. So there's a danger, and that's why preachers are afraid of preaching this, the real new birth, because they're afraid of losing somebody, they're afraid of causing a church split. So it takes us really back to the situation we had when they wouldn't let Wesley preach in the churches in England. They wouldn't let Whitfield. And Wesley said, I must preach there no more. He wrote in his journal, I must preach there no more. That means they wouldn't let him preach there. What is he preaching? The new birth. It's frightening. And I find today that many preachers are afraid of preaching a real conversion and dealing with their people for fear of losing somebody.
But of course, didn't Wesley go out and preach
in
the fields?
Oh, he went out in the fields.
Right.
Yes. He absolutely did. He went into the fields, and Whitfield did, and Whitfield then came over to America, I think 13 times, I believe it was 13 times, on that boat and preached here as well as in England, and great crowds of people. Benjamin Franklin came to hear him, and he was never converted apparently, but he came to hear him many, many times, and thousands. One time in Scotland, he preached to 150,000 people, and how he did that without a microphone, it's almost superhuman. They said you could hear him to the very ends of the crowd of people, and thousands of people were converted, and as you pointed out, it saved England and turned the Western world, turned the English-speaking world back to Christ, and stopped us from having the French Revolution. In my judgment, we need something like that today, but the people won't come out in the fields to hear you preach. But maybe they'll read a book, and that's why I've written this book, The Church That Will Be Left Behind, and the other book that you mentioned, A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation, which is actually Richard Baxter, one of the great, wonderful, wonderful Puritans. I took his book, A Treatise on Conversion, written in 1657, and I put it in modern English, so that it's real easy to read. Dr. Ian Murray of Banner of Truth Trust in Edinburgh, Scotland, said, I am sure that many will be thankful that Dr. Hymers has here reproduced Baxter's burning thoughts on conversion in this easily read and helpful format. So if a person's interested in this subject, and you talk, Dr. Monteith, about saving Western civilization, admirable, exactly right. But how can we save American civilization or Western civilization without a revival of real Christianity?
We can't, of course.
And I knew you'd agree with that. And that's why I've written The Church That Will Be Left Behind and A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation.
And they can get that through your ministry. Is there a telephone number they can call?
Look at the website, which is www.rlhymersjr. My name, R-L-H-Y-M-E-R-S-J-R, the J-R and the N, Junior, .com. It gives the phone number there. It's 818-352-0452. They can order that book by telephone, or they can order it from the website, or I think they can order it from you, can't they?
No, actually, we're not carrying them right now. We just haven't had a chance to get around to it. So if you'd like to find out more about the book, why don't you just call Dr. Hymers? Give that telephone number just one more time.
818-352-0452. The website is www.rlhymersjr.com. You could call anytime, we'll be glad to take your order over the telephone.
All right, nobody's there this time of night, are they?
It'll be tomorrow.
Yeah. All right, you call in tomorrow, but right now we're going to have to take a break. So we've got a 3-minute break, and when we get back, if you have a question for Dr. Hymers, our telephone number, 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California, or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and we'll be right back here in just a moment or two, and we'll just continue with this talk about the need for revival to save America. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I have to remind you out there in the listening audience that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you believe that there is a problem, if you believe we're involved in a great spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, educational, and even in a military battlefield, why, we hope many of you will decide that you're going to partner with us in our efforts to educate people out across America, indeed across the world. And God has given us a unique ministry now. We're heard on over 50 stations every week. Of course, some of them just half an hour a week, but even half an hour, you'd be amazed at how much information you can get out in half an hour and how you can get people to begin to think. And that's our job, is to really try to figure out how we can reach people, make them understand there's a problem. And, of course, when all is said and done, our solution is not going to be political. It's not going to be ideological. It's not going to be cultural. It's going to be scriptural. And if people don't turn back to God, if people turn their back on, continue turning their back on God, then God will turn his back on America and America will be lost. It's just that simple. We all need the Lord. And that's goes without saying. And of course, if you don't have a personal relationship with the Lord and you'd like to know more about it, you can get in touch with us. We'd be glad to talk to you about it. But there really is a transformation. I'll never forget when I accepted the Lord one night, and really my life changed at that point, and it's never been the same again. And you can have that same satisfying experience if you really want it. But you have to want it. You have to realize there's a problem. And you have to recognize the fact that, you know, that the Bible is accurate. It is God's Word. And, of course, he has given us the message and the information we need to understand what's going on in the world. And without that, we try to interpret it on our own. We're asking for nothing but a sorrow and tragedy. So if you believe that there's a problem and you'd like to be part of our effort to reach people, and of course, we talk about issues because that's what people want to hear about. We talk about the things that are going on in the world, but behind that is the acknowledgement that we truly are involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on many battlefields, political, ideological, and cultural. But it is truly a spiritual battle. And so if you'd like to join with us, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our September newsletter, which will give you an understanding of what really happened on September 11th, really is not at all what you've been led to believe. You have to understand the background of September 11th and then what has happened since then. And so I would be glad to send you free of charge as a September newsletter if you haven't had one before. Our October newsletter, which is just going to be finished very soon, really is the testimony of Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband, Ron Breitweiser, was in the South Tower of the World Trade Center on September 11th. And, of course, Kristen's testimony given before the Senate Select Committee has been totally ignored by the media. And yet in that short testimony, she says most of what needs to be said about what happened on September 11th and will raise questions that should haunt everybody who reads her testimony, and ask the question, well, why was this totally ignored by the mass media? Why were the facts that she brought out never mentioned by CBS, ABC, and NBC? And I hope that you'll be asking that question over and over again after you read my October newsletter, which is basically her testimony and my comments on it. So, of course, we'd be glad to send you an October newsletter. We'll send you either one or the other if you'd like it free of charge. And then, of course, we want to remind you that we are having a meeting at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course on November the 23rd. That's an all-day meeting, and it's going to start at 8:45 in the morning. Doors are going to open at 8 o'clock, and, of course, doors won't close until 6. And, of course, there'll be a luncheon. There'll be speakers all day long. And we're going to tell you how we think you need to prepare financially, physically, but especially spiritually for what lies ahead. Because if you're not prepared, why, I believe that an awful lot of people are not going to get through the very, very difficult times that I see and I can foresee coming. And I think that you'll be increasingly aware of that when you pick up the paper and you realize that they're planning on mobilizing almost 250,000 National Guardsmen for defense of America when we invade Iraq. Maybe it would be better not to invade Iraq. Then we wouldn't have to mobilize all these people to protect America. Who are we protecting them against? Why, of course, the wicked people, Islamic sympathizers, were here. Where did they come from? We brought them here back in 1990, 1991. They were members of Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard. We brought to America thousands and thousands of them, between 3,500 and about 8,000 of them, and we settled them all over America. Why would we settle people who were loyal to Saddam Hussein here? And well, maybe just for times like this. And under any circumstances, America, I believe, stands at the threshold of extremely difficult times. And I think we all need to be prepared for that, to understand what lies ahead, and we hope many of you will want to come. If you're interested in coming to the all-day seminar, our telephone number is 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We need to know how many are coming because there'll be lunches. That's 1-800-5-448-927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war today. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Dr. R.L. Hymers, Jr., and of course we're talking about two books, The Church That Will Be Left Behind, A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation, and Demons in the Smoke, those three books. And we're not going to talk about Demons in the Smoke. We've already done a program on that and another fascinating interview with the co-author of that book. And now, of course, let's talk a little bit about A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation. Would you like to pick up on that thought, Dr. Hymers?
Sure. You mentioned Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. My associate, friend of mine, Dr. John Waldrop, was on the program on that, and I was on too, and that book is also available. Dr. Waldrop's website is at it's called calvaryroadbaptist.org. You might want to look at his website. Just that, those words, calvaryroadbaptist.org, www. at the beginning of that. And my website is at www.rlhymersjr.com. And I've actually got several books, and you look at the website, you'll see them. Preaching to a Dying Nation is one. If you're interested in Charles Finney, and I think he's the bad guy, to be really honest with you, that really brought what I call decisionism. That's a word that I learned over in England. They call it decisionism. And he brought that into the churches. And if you're interested in the Finney problem, the book is Today's Apostasy. You'll see that on the website. But all of this is repeated, of course, in the book A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation. I became very, very interested in this man, Richard Baxter. He spent 18 months in the Tower of London in prison for preaching the gospel. Can you imagine 18 months in the Tower of London for preaching the gospel? While he was there in prison, the famous Bible commentator Matthew Henry went to see him very often and encouraged him. And this guy was so great that he preached before the king after being in prison. He preached before the king, preached before Parliament. And yet, he was a pastor of a little church, not a little church, of a big church, and in Kidderminster in England. And developed this plan of leading every member of his church into a real conversion experience. And he wrote about it in his book, A Treatise on Conversion. Baxter was a very, very, they call him Mr. Puritan. And yet, he wasn't completely a five-point Calvinist. He believed in free will. So he's more a little modified on that. A Treatise on Conversion is such a book that it's been published over and over and over. The American Tract Society published it many, many times, hundreds of editions, but it's so old, it's hard to read, you know. It's a little bit difficult to read. So what I did is I've read it three or four times, and I thought, you know, I'm going to take this book and put it in simple, modern English. And that's just exactly what I did. I just went right through it, and I took the long sentences and the big words, and I made it into simple sentences and simple words. And I think it will be very, very, very helpful and very interesting to you to read. The book is called A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation. And I wrote an introduction called Land of the Living Dead. You can read that. It's on my website, www.rlhymersjr.com. And you look on the website, you can read that introduction called Land of the Living Dead. And if it interests you, then buy the book, which gives the treatise on conversion in modern English.
Well, now, how will you get people to be converted? How can you actually get people to be willing to give up their own control of their lives and turn it over to the Lord? And this is one of the hardest things to do. Because,
well, it's impossible. Humanly, it's impossible, right. Dr. Monteith. And that's what the book is about. It takes a work of God's grace to awaken a person to see their need for Christ. And apart from the awakening and empowering of the Holy Spirit, a person is never going to be interested in the first place. A book like this, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, now, that's a Calvinist position. In other words,
no, I'm not a Calvinist.
You're not a Calvinist. Well,
no,
of course, the Calvinist says that, you know, it's predetermined whether we're going to become a Christian or not.
If you want to get into that, no.
I don't want to get
into it. Well, let me get into it just briefly. I think that maybe I should just briefly say that I am not a Calvinist. I reject there's 5 points of Calvinism. I reject the second, third, and fourth point. I do hold the first point, that man is totally depraved, and the last point. But I am not a Calvinist, but we can learn something from the Calvinists.
Oh, I think we certainly can. I think it's a fascinating discussion, but it for people who are not Christians, I think it's counterproductive.
Oh, yes, very much so.
The main question is, how does that individual out there who'd really like to become a Christian and finally get to the point where they're willing to take that final step and say, I really am willing to turn my life over to the Lord?
Yes, oh yes. Well, now, if a person is interested in that, then I would say, now this is my way of seeing it, that person needs, and I very much am a local church person, I would seek out a Bible-believing a pastor, and of course from my perspective I'd say a Baptist pastor, and I would go to that man, and he spent his whole life doing this. And I would ask him what to do, and then I would start going to church. And I think that's so important, and talk to the pastor about being converted. I always want to put it back on the local church, because I could tell people to say a prayer now here on the radio, and that would be good, and ask the Lord to forgive you and all of that. But I don't know your situation, and I don't know your particular problems. And to me, it would be far better for you to sit down with a man who has gone through Bible college and through seminary and who knows the Bible, and then who can listen to you and can listen to your problems and your particular situation and then lead you to Christ. So I would encourage people to go to a good Bible-believing church and talk to the pastor.
But, of course, people have to read the Scriptures. They have to recognize the truth of the Scriptures.
Oh, yes.
They have to know what Jesus claimed about himself. It's one thing to know that he lived, but who did he say that he was? And certainly, if we don't read the Gospels and the Gospel of John and each one of them and see how they correlate with one another, and, of course, Christ's claims, who did he say that he was? And, of course, only then, I think, can you really grasp the enormity of the offer that we have to become simply sons of the living God.
Amen. And I don't want people to get the impression that I think everyone is lost that goes to church. I don't think that at all. I think there are many fine Christians in our country and many fine pastors. One of the things people could do if they're really interested in finding out if you are converted is to get this book, A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation, and just read it. It's very simple reading. Chapter 1, The Miseries of the Unconverted. Chapter 2, Am I Converted? This is Baxter's book, A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation. It's very simple. Am I converted? You can read it, give yourself the test that he gives there. And Chapter 3, The Necessity of Conversion. Chapter 4, A Change of Mind. Chapter 5, A Change of Heart. Chapter 6, A Change of Life. Chapter 7, A Change of Affections. Chapter 8, An Appeal to the Unconverted. Chapter 9, Deliberate Neglect of the Means God Has Given. Chapter 10, Hindrances, Things That Stop Conversion. And then the afterword, 3 reprinted books that will help pastors restore our churches. All of this would be tremendously helpful. A child of 13, 14 years old, 12 years old could read this book and could be converted, I think, through reading it.
Well, this is what we really need, is something that will help people to understand conversion and really change their lives, because if they're truly converted, their life will never be the same again.
Never the same. And that would bring, of course, what we are hoping for, and what I know you're hoping for, is another great awakening. We have not had a great awakening in America since 1859. We had three great awakenings, one in the 1730s and 40s, and the second great awakening in the early 19th century, 1800 to about 1830, the third great awakening, 1859. But since 1859, our country has not really experienced revival, except for some of the effects of the Welsh revival, 1905, spilled over here, but we haven't really had a revival for a long, 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 long time.
But don't you think that part that's because, after the Civil War, why America became increasingly affluent? And then, of course, there was the liberal influence infiltrating the churches and the seminaries, and really, of course, was making the gospel and the message of the gospel change.
Yes, absolutely. And my thesis is that the way that liberalism got into the seminaries and into the churches, that's not the cause. See, my thesis is, my belief is, that that's not the cause, that's the result. The result of what? Of millions of people coming into the churches unconverted. So they wanted liberalism. That's the way it came in my opinion. So you've got to go back and cure the cause of the liberalism coming into the churches, which is the cause of people not being truly converted. When people are converted, they don't want liberalism in the churches. They'll throw the liberals out.
Well, don't you think that, I'd like your opinion on Charles Finney.
Do you
think he was a good man who thought that maybe he could improve on the old-fashioned ways, and he was a slick way of sort of marketing Christianity? And
well, I started out, now, Finney, now see, I've got I have a long relationship with Finney, because I started out thinking that he was the expert on revival and that he had the answer to it, and I read everything I could get my hands on and tried to put all of his things into practice, and then when I found that a lot of this didn't produce the right results, then I started reading the other side of it, and I have come to believe just the opposite of what I started to think. I believe that he was a very, very evil man that brought great ruin to our churches.
Well, do you think he did it intentionally or simply inadvertently, in trying to find a more convenient means of marketing Christianity?
Well, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, but let's say he did. But listen to this quotation. Quote, this is from Finney himself, quote, "Very little of the gospel has come out upon the world for these hundreds of years without being clogged and obscured by false theology," unquote. Now, Finney did not believe that Jesus Christ died for our sins. When I say that, you recoil. You say, oh, my goodness, said that. Oh, but he did. And he says it right in his Systematic Theology, which is very difficult to read, but if you plow through it, he said, quote, "Christ could not have died for anyone's sins but his own," unquote. So when you start out with a man not believing in the vicarious atonement of Christ and not believing in the true lostness of man, Finney thought that if you just presented the a good case for Christianity, that man was capable in and of himself of receiving it. And that made him quite different from John Wesley, who was an Arminian. And the fact is that this man was a Pelagianist. Now, those are big words, and your audience probably doesn't understand what they mean, but Finney was actually a heretic. And I use the word very cautiously, but what I mean by that is he embraced the ancient heresy of Pelagianism, that man is not truly lost, that he's capable of understanding the truth without the Holy Spirit. And that is not historic Christianity. It takes the Holy Spirit's illumination and help. And I'm not talking about rigid Calvinism. I'm talking about just mainstream Christianity. In the mainstream of Christian thought across the centuries, the belief has been that God has to help us or we cannot understand the gospel, and we cannot be saved.
And of course, the whole goes back to about the 4th century or 400, the argument between Augustine and Pelagius. And of course, Pelagius thought that through works, he didn't think that man was inherently depraved.
That's right.
And he also did not believe that man through his works could gain salvation, which was, of course, and Augustine said that was incorrect.
Yes.
But Pelagianism really was the, or semi-Pelagian, was the basic philosophy of the church really for many, many years.
Well, actually, you see...
Right up through Luther, wasn't it?
The Catholic Church is very interesting because the Catholic Church rejected Pelagius. But they rejected his doctrine, but then they kept it. So...
Well, they were sort of semi-Pelagians.
Well, yeah, so you have in the Catholic Church semi-Pelagianism. But let me give you a quotation from Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was very, very wise in regard to church history. He says, Finney was not an Arminian. He was a Pelagian. He did not believe in original sin, and he believed that the natural man, that means the unconverted man, by a process of reason, was able to grasp the truth and put it into operation. Man, he taught, is morally capable. Wesley never taught that, unquote. That's from Martin Lloyd-Jones, The Puritans, Their Origin, and Successors. And so I'm saying that we need to go back, be better to go back to a man like John Wesley, or a man like George Whitefield, or a man like Jonathan Edwards, and study what they taught, or a man like Richard Baxter. And that's why I took Baxter's book and put it in the modern English, and what it does is it corrects Finney. You read it, and you'll say, this is not decisionism. This is something different. This is completely different than anything I've ever heard before.
No,
this
right.
is different from what I heard Billy Graham say. This is a different way of looking at things, and very refreshing and very helpful. The book is called A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation.
Let's go to Herman, who's calling in from the Carmel area. Hi, Herman. How are you doing tonight?
Good evening. Great guest. A quick question. Do you foresee a big future for the home church movement here in America as it has done in China, especially if people are disenchanted with the organized, established churches?
Well, you say, do I see a future for the house church movement? Well, of course, I think that's what will happen after the rapture in the tribulation period. I think that the Christians will move into house, kind of a house church situation like you have in China today. Yes, I think that there is. I think that's what will happen. And very interestingly, if you read the book of Acts and the epistles of Paul, you find that the churches met in houses in the Roman world. Yes, I think you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else, Herman?
And also, you may have already covered this, but Jesus said before he returns, there would be a great falling away. Do you believe that
yes.
that has already occurred?
Oh, yes. And that's a good question, Herman. And yes, I started out, maybe you didn't hear the beginning of the broadcast, with 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and there's a comma, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. That's the Antichrist. So the first thing that happens is the falling away, and the Greek word is apostasia. It means a departure. And yes, I believe that started with Finney. I believe it started in the 19th century, and the Congregationalists, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the American Baptists, the Southern Baptists, now the Independent Baptists, are all experiencing that, falling away into apostasy, and it can only be cured. There's only way to cure it is to get church people converted.
And, of course, do you feel that the tempo of that apostasy is increasing at the present time?
Oh, yes. The tempo, you mean the tempo in Jerusalem?
No, the tempo of the apostasy. In other words, more and more people falling into apostasy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely, and we're going to see even more of that. And that results, you see, in the book of Revelation, in what's called the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, the apostate church of the end times.
Okay, the church of Laodicea, as it were. Yeah. Do you have anything else, Herman?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling. Okay, fine. Well, our guest this evening has been Dr. R.L. Heimers, Jr. And why don't you get out your website and your telephone number again for our listeners?
All right, you can get the books, any of the books, and they're all advertised on the website. And all of my sermons are given word for word. Every Sunday they put them out word for word on the website. You can read the sermons, and I think you'll find them quite interesting, too. It's www.rlhymersjr. J.R. is my dad. My dad was senior. I'm junior. My son is the third. And so you put the J.R. in the end, and then .com. And I'll be glad to talk to you. And if you have a book order, call me at 818-352-0452.
That's 818-352-0452. Okay. We've got that, and I hope you got that as well out there in the listening audience if you'd like to get the books. And again, we're talking about A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation. We're talking about the Church That Will Be Left Behind. Is that the right title?
Yeah, The Church That Will Be Left Behind, and The Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation.
Right, and then, of course, Demons in the Smoke, which is a fascinating book. And
Today's Apostasy is another one on Finney.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a fascinating hour, and I hope we can get you again on one of our other programs.
I love to talk about revival and great awakenings, and I'd love to come back again.
Thank you so much. Good night, sir. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I hope that you enjoyed the program this evening. It's certainly not as exciting as some, but it's sound, and you need to have the history. You need to understand the great awakenings in the past. And this is really what we need today, is another great awakening. And then, of course, you need to understand these ideas of Pelagianism and of course, Arminianism and Calvinism. And they're interesting. Certainly, it has nothing to do with your salvation. But you want to know the history of the church, and you want to know how we got to where we are today. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will pray for America, that you will pray for revival in this country, that you will pray for our ministers, because they should be leading, they should be certainly bringing out the facts that Dr. Heimers brought out so beautifully this evening. And so, of course, we ask you then to remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, and hope that you'll be able to come to our seminar out there at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. Of course, that'll be all day long on the 23rd of November of next month. And I hope it'll be a good time. I think you'll hopefully get a great deal of information, make it worthwhile coming. And we need to know, so if you can make it, our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.